Welcome to Great Decisions Part 18, the Yom Kippur War, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz. Le'ili Nishmas Yona ben Rav Aryeh Leib. On the eve of the Six-Day War, Israel found itself surrounded and extremely vulnerable. Its vital center was subject to easy attack and the country to severance. Its capital was surrounded on three sides, and its territory, armaments, and manpower were dwarfed by those of its enemies. Within a week, in June 1967, that all changed, and with it Israel's self-perception. Its territory more than tripled in size. The sense of breathing room relieved much of the anxiety with which Israelis had lived for two decades. The biblical heartland, including Yerushalayim, had been restored to Jewish control, and there was a pervasive sense that, although peace was not in the offing, neither was war. The Arabs had revealed themselves to be bumbling, incompetent, unmotivated, and desultory soldiers, collapsing before the brains and the brawn of the Jewish people. So it was a very heady time. That complacency, even arrogance, would be shattered in an instant on Yom HaKippurim 5734, October 6, 1973. Plans failed. Weaknesses were exploited. The danger of being overrun, certainly in the north, if not in the south, was real. There was a sense of peril and insecurity that to a large extent has never dissipated. The vaunted intelligence services failed. The casualty rate was breathtakingly high. And despite the fact that the early setbacks were followed by a stunning military victory, diplomacy robbed Israel of any sense of triumph. And the high casualty rate guaranteed that there'd be a pervasive gloom after the war. I want to focus less on the conduct of the war and its aftermath, although it leads up to that, to examine the great decision that preceded it. The decision of the political establishment led by the Prime Minister Golda Meir not to launch a preemptive strike, to lose the element of surprise, and to absorb a devastating first blow. So what happened? The Six-Day War was largely won in the first several hours when Israel's preemptive surprise attack destroyed the Arab air forces and allowed Israel easy harassment of enemy infantry and easy maneuverability on its own. The Yom Kippur War was also largely defined in its first few hours as well. The initial crossing of the canal, the Suez, by the Egyptians proved to be irreversible. On the Golan Heights, the Syrians made great inroads. At one point they captured most of the Golan Heights, and then they were repulsed and driven back. The Israelis came close to Damascus, but Israel was forced to pull back to lines that were less advantageous, and even had to surrender land they'd conquered in 1967. That is to say, they wound up in a worse position than before they were attacked, notwithstanding the defeat of the Syrian and Egyptian forces. But how do we get there? What led to what the Israelis have since termed Hamechdal, the failure? And how do we evaluate Golda Meir's decision not to preempt? Was it reasonable politically, albeit deadly to those who died as a result? Was it a colossal failure of resolve, a weakness of character? The first thing is we have to forever lose the notion that when Egypt and Syria attacked on October 6, 1973, 2 p.m. on Yom Kippurim afternoon, that the Israeli military and political establishments were surprised. That is just false. When they knew was a debatable issue. What the intelligence showed was also debatable, but by the morning of Yom Kippurim, they all knew what was happening and what was coming. So what happened? Who was to blame? It's always important to find out. And who was blamed? It's not always the same. The four separate tracks that we have to evaluate in order to understand how the decision was made, and to an extent they're all intertwined, each fed into the other, but each had a distinct importance as well. And these are the intelligence, military, diplomatic, and political tracks for both the Israelis and the Arabs. So let's look at the intelligence first, because that became the predominant issue after the war. The roots of the Yom Kippur War were nourished in a strategic environment that turned out to be flawed in the extreme, that was known in Israel as Hakonseptzia, a Hebrew word that we've used in English, known as a concept. And the concept really had a capital C, a capital Kuf in Israel. It was that product of the intelligence services that came into heavy criticism after the war. Specifically, Amman, the Agafa Modiin, military intelligence, and it was led in the year before the war by Eli Zaira, on whom was pinned much of the blame. But also the Mossad, Mossad Modiin, Tafkidim Yuchadim, the Institute for Intelligence and Special Tasks, headed by Tzvi Zamir. Now the concept had several components, and misguided, some would say hampered, Israeli strategic thinking before the war. There are three basic elements of the concept, and that colored everything that came afterwards. First, that Egypt would wage war in order to recover its lost territories. They knew that would happen at some point. But Egypt would only wage war when it felt it recover all of it, not just part of it. Second, this would require Egypt to find some solution to Israel's dominance in the air. As long as they felt in control of the air, they did not fear any war. The Six-Day War had been won in the air, and the IAF still gave Israel aerial supremacy that would hinder any Arab war effort. Now, it's interesting, this is still true so many years later. That's why Israel always objects to the sale of American fighter jets and missiles to Arab countries, and why Israel's always taken apart and reconstructed the avionics of American aircraft, not only to make them more suitable to Israeli needs, but also to ensure that it can do things of which even the Americans are not fully aware, all to maintain what successive governments have always called Israel's qualitative edge. Those are the first two. The third leg of the triangle of the concept was that Syria would go to war, but Syria would never go to war without Egypt. It would take the two of them together. So these three, that Egypt would never begin a war of partial aims, and not unless it first had a solution, either in aircraft or missiles, to Israel's air dominance, and that Syria would fight only in conjunction with Egypt, these were the clues. More than clues. These were the dominant theses that guided Israeli intelligence officials and the government itself. Now, these dated from the late 1960s and were firmly in place when Zaira became the Rosh Amman in 1971. So he tried to defend himself later by saying he inherited the concept, but he did fault himself in that he should have subjected it to his own review and analysis. Based on this, based on these three ideas, in December 1972 and in May 1973, Amman informed the government that the possibility of war in the near future was extremely unlikely. How entrenched was the concept? Consider. It led Israel to ignore the reports of a highly placed agent, a double agent, that worked for Israel, none other than Ashraf Marwan, who was Gamal Abdel Nasser's son-in-law, married to his daughter Mona. Even after Nasser's death in 1970, Marwan remained very active in Egyptian military and political circles. He began spying for Israel in 1969 while working in London. It's interesting, Marwan became a billionaire businessman, a partner in Harrods, with, among other things, with Mohammed Al-Fayyad. Do you remember him? His son Dodi was the Princess Diana's paramour, died with her. Marwan informed Israel first that Sadat was planning an attack in May 1973, and that was true. It was only called off, unknown to the Israelis, at the request of the Soviets, because there was an impending American-Soviet summit that was taking place that month, and they did not want this distraction. Marwan met with Tzvi Zamir on the eve of Yom Kippurim to tell him that war was imminent and would start on Yom Kippur itself. Interestingly, he said it would start at 6 in the afternoon. But Marwan was not believed. Eli Zairith thought him to be a double agent or triple agent, giving false information. And his information was rejected. It just didn't fit the parameters of a concept. They didn't see yet how Egypt would be able to overcome Israel's air might, nor that Egypt had the capacity to wage a war to reconquer all of Sinai. Now, Marwan's role was only revealed a decade ago. In 2007, he fell off his apartment terrace in London and died. That's interesting. His wife blamed the Mossad for killing him, and he was given a state funeral in Egypt. Mubarak attended, and for all we know, he could have been a triple agent, but who knows? How entrenched was the concept? A week before the war, King Hussein flew secretly to Tel Aviv, met Golda Meir, told her war was coming on Kippurim, and he was disbelieved. How entrenched was the concept? Yonah Bandman, who was the head of Amman's Egypt desk, filed this report, paragraph 440. And of course, a week, 2 weeks before the war, they saw a tremendous buildup of manpower, weaponry, preparations on the other side of the canal in Syria as well. Bandman filed this report. Lamrod she'etzim tvisat maracha chayrim b'chazit yet Allah. Notwithstanding that the emergency state on the battlefield has increased, there's heightened preparations. Tuman b'chavo l'charsi menim meidim l'yozmat ta'et tapit. Buried within it, the possibility, the signs indicating that there's some type of aggressive initiative planned. Harei lefi meitav harachatenu lochal shinui barachat ha-mitzvim et yachasei kochot beinam beitzal. Still, nonetheless, there's no change in the balance of forces between Egypt and the IDF, meaning the concept still exists. Ilechach. Based on this, the probability that Egypt is intending to initiate hostilities is nimucha, low, low, very low. When did he file that report? Erev Yom HaKippurim. That is a big mistake. So of course he lost his job after the war. That's in Amman. The truth is, it was a bad year for the Mossad as well. They were distracted by other things. In 1973, you'll recall that they were in the middle of what was called Mitsa Zam HaKel, Operation Wrath of God, assassinating across the world anyone who participated in the Munich massacre. July 21st, 1973, just 2.5 months before the war, they identified a perpetrator, Ali Hassan Salameh, gunned him down on the streets of Lillehammer, Norway, and then discovered they had killed the wrong man, an innocent man. Six agents were arrested, five sentenced to prison terms. They were eventually cut short. Eventually they killed the right guy in Beirut in January 1979. But you could see how in the months before the war they were preoccupied with other things. That was the intelligence track, and no doubt the intelligence was a colossal failure. Militarily, the Egyptian front had not been quiet for years, really not since the Six-Day War. There was bitterness and tremendous shame in Egypt about the humiliation they suffered, and the Arabs still place a great deal of importance on psychological concepts such as honor. Within weeks after the Six-Day War ended, Egypt provoked hostilities along the Suez Canal, and Nasser vowed to retake by force the sacred Egyptian land that had been seized by Israel. How sacred was it? Sinai became an Egyptian territory only because the Ottomans gave it to them in 1906. It's 60 years of holiness behind it. But from an Israeli perspective, the great victory in 1967 gave them something they had never had before, strategic depth, and this enabled them to shift their military doctrines as well, and probably incorrectly in retrospect. So before, Israel's military strategy had always called for preemptive strikes, taking advantage then of its air superiority and the great mobility of its infantry, and of course the need to always wage war in the enemy's territory and not on its own land. And everyone always recognized that Israel, because of its small size, and its limited manpower, and its economic resources, could not maintain a large standing army, had to rely on reserves, nor could they engage in a protracted war. After the Six-Day War, amongst the strategic thinkers, all this changed dramatically, and the predominant voices among Israel's thinkers now held that Israel could withstand a first strike, because on the Egyptian front there was now a buffer of about 150 miles till they came to the old border. There was 16 minutes of warning time of an airstrike, whereas before it was 3 or 4 minutes. On the Jordanian front, Yerushalayim was now out of artillery range. Remember, 1948, 1967, the city itself was shelled. Only the Golan lacked a buffer. But as we know, Syria was not attacking alone. But by the way, it was true. What Israel did was deviate from its traditional doctrine, not only in terms of the preemptive strike or surprise attack, but the doctrine of maintaining mobility of movement, and they built a static line of defense along the Suez Canal. This was the initiative of the Chief of Staff, Chaim Bar-Lev, and the scheme was researched and implemented by Avram Adan, Bren. Every Israeli general has a nickname. That was Bren, and General Yishayel Gavish, Shaika Gavish, who had commanded the Sinai front during the Six-Day War. So the fortifications were built in response to an Egyptian artillery barrage that killed 18 Israeli soldiers in November 1968. What did they do? They constructed about 30 fortified bases right up to the Suez Canal, each fortification manned by about 15 soldiers or so, scattered at distances of 7 miles one from the other, with a territory in between guarded by mobile patrols and artillery units. The entire length of the canal was fronted by a sand wall barrier about 80 feet high, along with anti-tank ditches. And they felt there'd be no way, considering the ditches on their side of the canal and the sand embankments, that Egyptian infantry could ever penetrate that barrier. Of course, the Egyptians countered by building their own embankment 130 feet high, from which they could gaze down on the Israelis and practice their crossing maneuvers undetected. 5 miles inland, Israel built other fortifications with even greater manpower. Now, this cost over $300 million to build, which was real money back then, no longer today. And it was vehemently opposed by a number of generals, including Ariel Sharon and his guru, the father of the Merkava, Yisrael Tal. So they did not like the deviation from Israel's strategic doctrine. They felt the people of fortifications were sitting ducks. Both felt the main unit should be based miles off the canal, as the current setup would allow an Egyptian invader to break through at any of the weak points and overrun the fortifications, cutting them off from their supplies, and also left them as sitting ducks in the interim. They lost the argument, although Sharon, when he became the Chief of Southern Command in 1971, he added more fortifications inland, but he also let the maintenance of the fortifications along the Suez Canal lapse, and about half of them were empty when the war started. Now, Gavish had felt that the Suez was a natural barrier, and if Israel did not maintain forces there in great number, it would just encourage the Egyptians to attack and establish the foothold. So you lose the opportunity to use the Suez Canal as that great anti-tank ditch. And since Israel's strategy always called for taking the war to the enemy's territory, it makes sense for Israel to have a strong presence on the canal itself. Now, it's hard to fault either side. Both sides are very logical. You don't know what would have been different. But nonetheless, it's a good argument. Sadly, those people on the Bar-Lev line would be the very first victims of the Yom Kippur War, with very few survivors. Conversely, because the two forces were positioned right against each other, right opposite each other, across from the canal, they could, some parts, even hear each other's conversations, the Israeli and Egyptian soldiers, Israel was unable to distinguish accurately what was considered normal maneuvers or an unusual buildup of forces that foreshadowed an actual war. So in theory, the Bar-Lev line was supposed to halt an initial advance and give Israel up to 48 hours to mobilize its troops. That also didn't work out. As one military correspondent later described it, it was too lightly manned to stop the Egyptians, but it was too heavily manned simply to serve as a tripwire. Again, both sides were logical, but looking in retrospect, Israel has constructed nothing similar to the Bar-Lev line along any of its other borders in the decades since. When the war broke out, the fortifications were overrun by the sheer number of Egyptian forces, and the sand walls were knocked down by what?
Water.
You would think it's so obvious. Water cannons operating with water being pumped from the canal. All it took was an hour or two to make breaches in one lightly or undefended place along the sand embankment, make two breaches, large enough for tanks and infantry to traverse, and with the pontoons, they were across. So they found the seams in the defense line, and that's all it took, and the Kav Bar-Lev was no longer. Ironically, the Bar-Lev line was one of the causes of the War of Attrition, Melchemet Atasha, that lasted from March 1969 until July 1970. So again, in retrospect, rather than save lives, it cost lives. Melchemet Atasha was the least recognized of Israel's wars. In fact, I only think in the last 3 or 4 years, it was formally acknowledged as an official war. Nasser felt that the building of permanent fortifications along the Suez meant that Israel would never leave. So the war consisted mainly of Egyptian artillery and rocket barrages, followed by Israeli retaliations, including some airstrikes deep into Egypt. But roughly 700 Jews were killed in the War of Attrition, including my cousin Yehuda, more probably in the War of Attrition than even in the Six-Day War, until a ceasefire was implemented in August 1970. And even that was ominous. There were two dramatic developments. So Israel was bombing Egypt's new SAM missile site, surface-to-air missiles, that were based off the canal that gave Israel a buffer zone. They didn't want it at all. The ceasefire was conditioned upon Egypt not moving its missiles into the canal zone, which of course they promptly did. Israel was furious, but the U.S., preoccupied in Vietnam, did nothing and convinced Golda Meir to do nothing, and not for the first time. In outrage, Menachem Begin resigned from the cabinet, he'd been part of the government since before the Six-Day War. With that, with the SAM missiles now on the Suez, Egypt had the ability to harass the IAF on Israel's side of the canal and limited air maneuverability within 12 miles of the canal because that was the range of the missiles. So Egypt was well on its way to neutralizing Israel's air power, which was one prerequisite for war. And then as now, Israel feared an imposed American settlement. The second development. In early 1970, Nasser visited the Soviet Union, and he returned with Soviet equipment and personnel, upping the ante in the Cold War, and eventually more or less subcontracting Egypt's air defense to the Soviet Union. To a large extent, the Soviets actually manned their defenses for a few years. By September, the U.S. had begun major shipments of weapons to Israel to counter the Soviet supply to Egypt. That boosted the confidence of the Israelis, as did King Hussein's obliteration of the PLO during its uprising in Jordan in September 1970, Black September. Now we know nothing less than an attempt by Arafat to establish to overthrow the Jordanian monarchy and establish his terrorist state there, as he later did in Gaza. Syria, which had tried to intervene on behalf of Arafat, was thwarted by America. We also know by Israel that mobilized its forces to prevent the Syrian incursion into Jordan. In 1971, the concept looked secure and viable. But something else was happening. Egypt, the bumblers and stumblers of 1967, had learned their lessons. They recruited university students and thereby upgraded their officers' corps. They studied the fundamentals of Israel's victory in 1967, no doubt aided by the Soviets. They formulated a military strategy accordingly. So recognizing Israel's doctrine of surprise preemptive attacks, a lightning attack followed by a short conflict, because of Israel's economic and social inability to maintain a longer war, so they decided when war came, at the time of their choosing, Egypt would attack first. And they would try to use their depth and their manpower and their resources and, frankly, their disregard for their soldiers' own lives against Israel. And they did. One Egyptian wrote at the time, if Israel loses 10,000 soldiers, their society would collapse. Where Egypt could lose 50,000, no one would pay attention. Except the families, I guess. The war would be protracted. They planned a 7-8 week war, bleeding Israel in every way. There would be another front as well. Now remember, 1967, the war unfolded sequentially. Israel first dispatched Egypt, then dispatched Jordan, then dispatched Syria. They didn't really have to fight major battles on every front simultaneously. That would change here, forcing Israel to fight a multi-front war at the same time, which they really hadn't done since 1948 in entirely different circumstances. And when Nasser died in September 1970, he was replaced by Anwar Sadat, held to be a bland lackey of more powerful Egyptians, some of whom actually probably said that phrase, bland lackey of more powerful Egyptians, and he put them in jail for life a year later. Sadat opened up to the U.S. and already in 1971 devised the strategy that is in effect today that would drive a wedge between Israel and the Americans, a strategic objective of the Arabs until today, and in fact probably the major development in the last year. The Iran has succeeded in just doing that, driving a wedge between America and Israel, elevating its own profile and status in the Middle East, and weakening Israel. But Sadat did something else as well, and another element of the concept fell by the wayside. He decided to wage a limited war to recover the Suez Canal, part of Sinai, maybe the oil fields, maybe not, but not conquer Israel. Now this dismayed his Syrian counterpart, Hafez al-Assad, who had been shamed as the head of the Syrian Air Force in 1967 and had seized power in 1970. Assad felt no such limitations. Sadat was different. All right. For sure, it's arguable what Sadat's real intentions were. I mean, this is what he wrote. And when Egypt attacked, they attacked with fury and with hatred. But it's also true, apparently, that they had no battle plans in place after the initial attack and conquest of the canal. They had no plans to take the war to Israel. Of course, they did engage in heavy fighting at the Midland Gidi Passes and other places as well that were far from the canal. But who knows? Sadat himself claimed he had only limited objectives, and really that's how he fought the war. The third track was the diplomatic. Sadat also saw that the diplomatic track was stalled. There have been a few attempts at peace, so-called peace, that despite the fact that Israel voted right after the war, Six-Day War, to withdraw from Sinai and from the Golan Heights, the Arabs at Khartoum a few months later vowed the three no's, no peace, no recognition, no negotiations with Israel, period. Nonetheless, the Rogers Plan was presented by the U.S. in late 1969. William Rogers was the Secretary of State. It called for almost a full withdrawal in exchange for peace, and Nasser rejected it. Now, after he died, Israel's Minister of Defense, Moshe Dayan, himself suggested that Israel should pull back from the Suez, let it reopen under Egyptian civilian control. Sadat agreed, but the suggestion foundered on Sadat's demand that the Egyptian military be allowed to cross. In early 1971, Sadat offered in an interview to recognize Israel and live in peace. Golda Meir remained suspicious. The UN's Gunnar Yaring began a shuttle diplomacy that tried to talk Israel into accepting Sadat's demands, as did the American Undersecretary of State, Joseph Sisko, went back and forth, and nowhere. And Sadat began playing off the Soviets from the Americans. He'd become frustrated when the Soviets, anxious to pursue détente with Nixon's America, were not as responsive to Egypt's needs as Sadat had hoped. In July 1972, it was a big storm, he expelled the 25,000 Soviet advisors that were guiding his military It was a big storm. Within a few months, many had returned, and they took an active role in the preparations for war. Remember, Egypt was a Soviet bridgehead in the Middle East. Like at this point now, America was beginning to see Israel that way. Later, in March 1973, the Soviets began shipping to Israel both Scud missiles, very long range, and advanced SAM missiles, which Sadat deployed again to overcome Israel's air supremacy. By the spring, Sadat was speaking openly of war. It's amazing how Harrison got away with this. He gave a Newsweek interview, April 1973, in which he said he has no choice but to wage war. And he was serious. But now he felt he had a solution, or at least a workable approach, to Israel's dominance in the air. But Israeli intelligence still assumed that without MiG-23s, Egypt would never attack, and that again colored their analysis of the events as they unfolded. I mentioned he planned to attack first in May 1973. Such had been reported to Israeli intelligence. He backed down at the Soviet request, but Israelis assumed it was just Sadat's indecisiveness. It was the third time he had done such a thing. Nonetheless, in response to the preparation reports, the chief of staff, General David Elazar, ordered a partial mobilization that cost a lot of money and came to naught. And that would prejudice Israel's reaction 5 months later. When he requested full mobilization before Yom Kippurim, he was denied. Blamed anyway, but he was denied. Additionally, Sadat cemented his ties with Hussein of Jordan and Assad of Syria. The three meeting in Cairo just 3 weeks before the war, it was then that Hussein learned of the plans. He wisely decided for the most part to stay out of the war, even to notify the Israelis on the sly, but nothing came of them. He was out, once burned, twice shy. But with Assad, their war plans dated back to May, and now they're ready to be implemented. In September, Sadat notified King Faisal of Saudi Arabia, and he agreed also. He sent a brigade or two, but mainly he promised to use the oil weapon against the West. In retrospect, many Israelis would say that their government failed to exploit opportunities for peace, but it's quite unlikely that even the relative quiet of the last 30 years would have been possible without the Arabs regaining some of their lost pride. Sadat had even offered a non-belligerency pact, not peace, in exchange for full withdrawal. When that was rejected, he vowed he would retake Sinai, even if it cost him 1 million soldiers. Lots of 1 million soldiers between friends. But many recent accounts insist that Sadat wanted a limited victory in order to spur negotiations. Assad, of course, had no such illusions. To him, reconquering the Golan was a military decision, a Syrian imperative, and he had no interest in peace with Israel. After there was a conference in Geneva, he just didn't show up. The fourth track is the political track, and it's also important. Golda Meir had assumed office after Levi Eshkol died in February 1969. Born in Kiev, raised in Milwaukee, married, made Aliyah. She left her husband at a relatively young age to devote her life to party and politics. He died, Morris, in any event, in 1951. She became a high-ranking Mapai official, held a series of posts, a first ambassador to the Soviet Union, a number of cabinet posts, including foreign minister in Ben-Gurion's second tenure as prime minister. Ben-Gurion once said of her, "She's the only man in my cabinet." Well, that toughness would be tested, and part of the problem is she herself conceded she had no military experience. And she relied heavily on her military attaché. She just didn't, you had a novice in the position. At that time, as noted, Moshe Dayan was still a defense minister, still from before the Six-Day War. He's a big hero, dashing, larger than life. But he epitomized the hubris that afflicted Israelis and made them feel invincible. Just a few weeks before the war, September 11, 1973, Israel shot down 12 Syrian aircraft over the Golan, over Syria, to just the loss of one of their own, and that underscored their air dominance. Israel in September 1973 was still riding high, with the Labor Party in solid control of every organ of society and looking forward to new elections that were scheduled for the end of October 1973. On October 1st, orders were given to both Egyptian and Syrian operations staff for their forces to be on alert. Now, before then, only a handful of people in Egypt knew that war was imminent. The attack was planned for 5 days hence, October 6th, 2:05 p.m., which was both the 10th of Tishrei, Yom Kippurim, and the 10th of Ramadan. Now, already a month before, troops have been concentrated on the west bank of the Suez and in Syria. The Egyptians were meticulously planning their attack, experimenting with ways to break through the sand walls, eschewing explosive, which didn't work, for the water cannons, which did, rehearsing their initial attack. They rightly assumed that Israel would be less prepared on Yom Kippur, and rightly assumed they would least expect the Arabs to attack during Ramadan. And he assumed as well that he would lose, Sadat assumed he would lose 10,000 soldiers in the initial crossing. Little did he realize how defenseless the Israelis in Sinai would be. But the Egyptian preparations were described as maneuvers and dismissed by Israel. And to further maintain the deception, 95% of the Egyptian army thought the same until Yom Kippur morning, when they were told they were attacking. And what was Israel doing? On October 4th, Thursday, the foreign minister, Abba Ibn, was meeting with the new American Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, to discuss upcoming negotiations. Both dismissed the possibility of war, and yet it wasn't a complete surprise. The intelligence is always the province of estimates and analysis. It relies on hunches as much as on data. Not everyone was fooled. There were differing levels of assessments. Eli Zaira, Rosh Aman, dismissed any notion that the Arabs would attack. Tzvi Zamir was not as certain. Dayan was inclined to go with Zaira, and this despite the fact that Zaira had reported extensively on the ground units being deployed, the construction of the ramparts, the mobilization of Egyptian civil defense, the bringing to the canal of the pontoon bridges. War did not fit the conception. One junior military intelligence official, Lieutenant Binyamin Simantov, that's a good name, he wrote on October 1st that the Egyptian deployments and exercises along the Suez Canal seemed to be camouflaged for real canal crossing assault. He saw it coming. It's just lieutenant. He was ignored. On October 3rd, he filed a more extensive and more comprehensive analysis, and his report was not only ignored, it didn't even reach Eli Zaira. But at least one guy was right. Chaim Herzog wrote the famous book, War of Atonement. He titled this chapter in his book, Einayim Lohem Velo Yiru. They have eyes, but they see not. And yet he's mostly forgiving to the culprits. Nor did they know, and this is also important, they didn't know what the attack would be. And many possibilities. Full-scale war, battle, the beginning of another war of attrition. Dado Elazar, late that week, began pushing for full mobilization because he suspected it was war. At the very least, he wanted to prepare for war, but his request was dismissed, and he was unfairly scapegoated after the war by the politicians. On the ground, at the Suez, at the beginning of October, the Israeli generals saw what was happening on the other side and ordered a full alert. But they were denied in their request to take stronger measures. They saw the Egyptians working feverishly on their ramparts, preparing the pontoons. On October 4th, Thursday, they saw as well, they've heard through intelligence, that the Soviet diplomatic families had been evacuated. In the north, General Yitzhak Kofi, who was later the head of Mossad under Begin, reported that the Syrians were preparing for war, and the politicians were still silent. That same day, Thursday, the cabinet was informed that with the preparations underway, both armies could readily begin a war, and they would meet again to consider the situation on Sunday. What's the decision? On November 13th, 1973, the Knesset held a debate on the conduct of the war. And it was the midst of the depression into which Israel fell after the war. Menachem Begin, again in opposition, was at his most impassioned and eloquent, and I quote from his speech in the Knesset. Did we, Madam Prime Minister, at noontime on Yom Kippur, have armor and infantry mobilized along the two fronts, north and south, ready to inflict a preemptive blow on the enemy? No, Madame, we did not. What did we have along those fronts? We had the finest and bravest troops any nation could wish for, but they were so thinly stretched, any preemptive action on their part would have been suicidal. And the truth is, given the advanced missiles at the canal at the time, even the Air Force probably could have done nothing. Continued. The question every household in Israel is asking is, why was it that between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you did not mobilize the reserves and move our armor forward? What prevented you, Gvarat, Prime Minister, from taking this most elementary of precautionary measures? You knew well in advance of the massive Egyptian and Syrian preparations for an imminent attack, and yet you did not even admit this to your own government, and you overruled your own chief of staff when he wanted to stage a preemptive strike. Now, Begin admitted that a preemptive strike would have been a momentous decision to be pondered a thousand times, but he said, with an enemy concentrating his forces before your very eyes and still to do virtually nothing, he continued, if we had called up reserves 4 days before Yom Kippurim and sent 500 tanks to the Golan, 700 tanks to Suez, what a difference that would have made. I quote, one of two things would then have happened. Either there would have been no war at all, Moscow would have warned them, don't attack, the Jews are ready and waiting, or yes, the enemy would have attacked, but the Egyptians would never have gotten across the canal. We would not have had to pull back in the north. But where were those forces at noontime on Yom Kippur? I shall tell you where, Madam Prime Minister. The weapons were in their depots, and the crews were at home. So how did this happen? General Elazar had been warning about the probability of war, full-scale war, since the spring, simply because Sadat wanted to break the status quo, the diplomatic stalemate. General Yisrael Tal predicted the Arabs would use the oil weapon to mobilize international opposition to Israel. One problem was that there had already been three major mobilizations since 1971 without any hostilities, and this weighed heavily, even as the Israelis observed the Egyptians moving their equipment and artillery up to the canal. On October 5th, the Navy noted such intense preparations and said that war had to be imminent. It was still rejected. There were other considerations as well. The government was distracted that very week because two Arab terrorists had hijacked a train transporting Soviet Jews to Vienna. Hostages were being held. Goldmeier flew to Europe to deal with that and only returned to Israel on Wednesday, October 3rd. The cabinet met and they discussed and they would meet again. On Friday, word came in that the Soviets had evacuated the families of the diplomats, anxieties were raised, an emergency cabinet meeting was called on Erev Yom Kippurim, and a decision was made not to mobilize, but to alert the reserve mobilization centers in case mobilization was necessary. More intelligence came in pointing to war on Friday, but was not provided to the chief of staff until Yom Kippur morning. And still, as we saw, military intelligence spoke of the low probability of war. Those who were wrong were dead wrong, but their voices carried the day. On the morning of Yom Kippurim, Eli Zaira was awakened at 4 a.m., with confirmed reports that the Arabs would attack that very afternoon. Elazar phoned the chief of the Air Force, Benjamin Peled, to ask how long would it take to prepare a preemptive strike. Peled said, if you order it now, we'll be ready to go 11 a.m. At 10 to 6, Elazar, early in the morning, Elazar met with Dayan and asked for permission to attack the Syrian Air Force and missile systems and to begin full mobilization. Dayan denied both requests, agreeing only to mobilize one brigade in the north and one in the south, but 3,000 to 5,000 troops each. War was expected at 6 p.m. At 8 a.m., they all met with Golda Meir, Dayan, Yisrael Galili, Elazar, Zaira, others. Dayan still opposed full mobilization and a preemptive strike. They approved a larger mobilization to begin immediately, 100,000 men. Elazar disobeyed and ordered Golda Meir, but denied the request for a preemptive strike. Later, Dayan would claim he favored a preemptive strike, but Meir opposed. And she really had no knowledge other than what she was told by her attaché. But there was another compelling factor that was inhibiting her, and that was the American connection. The NSA, National Security Agency, is back in the news now. The NSA knew of the attack days before the war, by Tuesday, Wednesday of that week, by intercepting Egyptian phone conversations. You know, they don't do that anymore. In Egypt, they don't do it in America. They sat on the information at the demand of the Nixon administration. It's very interesting. One NSA analyst, Bruce Brill, made Aliyah years later, wrote in the Jerusalem Post in 1992 that he carries with him forever guilt and shame that he allowed Jews to die, knowing that if he had revealed the information, even illegally, like Pollard did, he could have saved thousands of Jewish lives. The administration policy was articulated by Henry Kissinger. So he too was in doubt early in the week whether there'd be an attack, but he warned Israel not to strike first. And he said that if they did, they would lose all American support, military and diplomatic. And his attitude was summarized in his own words. He said to his aide, he wants Israel, quote, to come out ahead, but bleed. He wants them to feel pain, to suffer losses, thinking that would make them more flexible, more pliable in the post-war negotiations. Now, this is evidenced by the classified documents. I have right here the cable that he sent Yom Kippur morning to the White House Situation Room. It's labeled top secret, sensitive, exclusive eyes only, but you're all included. Actually, it was declassified in 2000. So it's a message he sent to Dobrynin, Anatoly Dobrynin, who was the Soviet foreign minister. And he said that he was notified the Israelis have what they consider to be hard information that Egyptians and Syrians were planning to launch a coordinated attack within 6 hours. We are urgently communicating with the Israelis, warning them against any preemptive attack. Note the language. It's a very strong word to use. Warning another nation not to attack. They called Shalev, the Israeli Shalje. Shalev was the aide to Eliezera. Told him, I talked to Dobrynin, I emphasized in the essentiality of restraint on the Israeli part and said there must be no preemptive strike. Shalev called back shortly thereafter, told his cable, said his government assured us there would be no preemptive action. Shortly thereafter, we received a message from Prime Minister Meir confirming this. She called the American ambassador that morning, Kenneth Keating. Remember, he was U.S. Senator from New York. Bobby Kennedy defeated him in 1964. Keating then reported to the State Department that Israel had told the Americans they would not launch a preemptive strike. That's important to remember this because Kissinger was a Russia with a pathological attitude towards his own Jewish upbringing, with a need to prove himself to non-Jews, and then a need to revise the record to show how much he did for Jews. In fact, he was a tremendous obstacle during the Yom Kippur War. When she told Kissinger that they would not preempt, that was not a military decision, that was a political decision. And no doubt she flinched. The war started 4 hours before they thought it would, and started very ominously for Israel. So what happened? The air assault began in the north and south around 2 p.m., Yom Kippur afternoon. The ground assault followed, 100,000 Egyptian soldiers attacking 450 Israelis stationed on the Bar Lev line. Half were killed quite quickly. Almost the other half were taken captive. A few escaped. The Syrians broke through on the Golan. The battles were fierce and deadly. More Israelis were killed in the first day of the Yom Kippur War than in the entire Six-Day War. By Monday, Egypt had advanced well beyond the second ring of fortifications that were 5 miles inland. They advanced about 10 miles inland already. Israeli counterattacks had failed. The SAM missiles were destroying Israeli aircraft by the dozens, and therefore they could not inhibit the advance of the infantry. By the fourth day, Dayan was losing hope and offered to resign. It was rejected. He suggested Israel activate its nuclear weaponry. That was done. About a dozen tactical atomic bombs were assembled for use and loaded onto missiles, but they were not used. And the tide turned, and it turned dramatically. on the southern Golan Heights, nothing less than a nace happened, and I've heard this from people who weren't there. The Syrians advanced the southern part of the plateau like a knife through butter, and suddenly just stopped on the edge, overlooking Tveria. There was nothing between them and Tveria, and so they thought it was a trap. They thought it was an ambush, that if they advanced further, the Israelis would mow them down. So they waited a day. And by the time they realized that there was no one there, the reserves with tanks had arrived. By midweek, Israeli supplies were running low, another 4 days, till the following Sunday. Israel's U.S. ambassador, Simcha Dinitz, was in Israel. He was sitting Shiva for his father, Shiva ended, of course, every Yom Kippurim. Flew back to Washington, Yom Kippurim, on a special plane. Israelis always flew commercial. They had to get a Navy jet to fly in. He pleaded for a resupply. Nixon agreed, but it wasn't simple. Every European country refused overflight requests. Landing requests for refueling. And overflight. Weeks later, Golda Meir lambasted her fellow socialists for their betrayal, thinking somehow, for some reason, she said this, that their common socialist brotherhood would have overcome, should have overcome their love of oil. She learned otherwise. By the end of the week, it was a stalemate until Israel turned the tide in the south. And the tank battles in the south were enormous, the largest in the world since the Battle of Kursk in 1943, that sealed the fate of the Nazis in Russia. Ariel Sharon had been recalled to active duty, and he led the forces across the canal. Now, the thing is, a lot of misinformation, because that was always Israel's war game in the south, always to take the fight to the enemy's territory. That wasn't his initiative. In fact, Sharon asked by his aide on the first day of the war, how is this all going to end? He says, it's going to end with us on the western bank of the Suez. Because that was always Israel's strategy. The American resupply began a week and a half into the war after Kissinger, who later claimed credit for it, delayed and delayed. He was overruled by Nixon, but more involved and less heralded in this decision was the White House Chief of Staff, Alexander Haig, Zachor Latov. I just read, he died a few years ago, his home in Palm Beach was put up for sale the other day, $10 million. He did well. But Zachor Latov, he sent everything that could fly with the refueling stops in the Azores off the Atlantic coast, Portuguese territory, and he defied Kissinger, even talked him down. It was actually not Sharon, it was his division, but it was Donny Mott's brigade that first crossed the canal on October 15th. 9 days after the war started. I mention that because Donny Mott just died 2.5 weeks ago when we were in Israel. Then others followed. A fierce battle was fought, and in this Sharon was involved, at the Chinese farm, on the so-called Chinese farm, on the Israeli side of the canal, north of the Great Bitter Lake. Why was it called the Chinese farm? Because from the air, it was an agricultural station where they had Japanese-made equipment. And from the air, Japanese, Chinese, it all looks the same. So Israelis called it the Chinese farm. About 300 Israelis were killed in that battle. And there was heavy fighting at the Gibi Pass, the Mitla Pass. But within days, Israel was ensconced on the west bank of the canal, holding territory 25 miles wide, 20 miles deep, just outside Ismailia, where they were stopped. But the Egyptian Third Army that had crossed into Sinai, they were surrounded. In the north, the Syrians were repulsed after heavy fighting that was much shorter in duration than in the south. And casualties were very high. You know, Tzipi in our office, her husband Yaakov's brother was killed on the third day of the war in the Golan. Their son David is named, David is named for him. By the fourth day, though, the Syrians were expelled from the Golan Heights. Damascus was bombed, and then Israel had a choice. And this was debated over the course of a long day. Should they just retain the Golan or go into Syria? And they made a political decision. Golda Meir said, let's go into Syria. The generals were against it because from the Golan, we all know the area, you look down, it's a commanding position. Why go into Syria and then have to defend flat terrain with a plateau in back of you? But Golda Meir said, we're not going to end the war with no gain on the Golan and a loss in the Sinai, because that's a political disaster. Indeed, they advanced into Syria, stopped just 40 kilometers outside of Damascus, but people died. And within weeks, Israel withdrew from that territory anyway. Not an unfamiliar tale. Less than 3 weeks after the war started, a ceasefire slowly, gradually went into effect. It didn't take at first. Kissinger played a dominant role. You know, Nixon was completely distracted by Watergate. Remember the Saturday Night Massacre? He fired Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor. That was October 20th, which was 2 weeks into the war. He had other things on his mind. Kissinger would force Israel to withdraw on both fronts. That would have made sense, but that both Israel and Egypt withdraw their forces from the other's side of the canal. But Sadat had categorically ruled out withdrawing his forces, because that was his accomplishment. He wanted to remain in the canal. Categorically ruled out. Since Israel categorically rules out nothing, it is left as the only side that can make concessions. And they did, kicking and screaming, but they did, in the Sinai and on the Golan. And it became only the first of a series of diplomatic defeats. Israel ultimately withdrew from Sinai piece by piece, after repeated threats from Kissinger, including the infamous reassessment, 1975, reassessment of America-Israel relations during the Ford presidency, and then surrendering it entirely as a result of the Camp David Accords. So, what's the outcome? That's one outcome. There are others as well to think about. The Yom Kippur War was the last multi-front war that Israel fought. It hasn't fought many, just 48 and 73, maybe 67. But for the 40 years since, the conflict has centered on either Lebanon or on and or the domestic enemy within Israel, which of course they never want to fight, but that's where the war is today. It was a deadly war. Approximately 2,700 Israelis were killed. Thousands more were injured, many grievously. Hundreds of Israeli prisoners were tortured, both by the Egyptians and the Syrians, but especially by the Syrians, who are just a sadistic people, as we now know. Many were summarily executed, including 28 by one Syrian soldier wielding an axe who just decapitated them and then ate part of the body of one, which now we know is no big surprise. And he literally received a medal from Mustafa Tlas, the defense minister, for his work. That's what we're dealing with. Israelis have debated for four decades who should be blamed. The elections, scheduled for late October, postponed to December 31st because of the war, began a lamentable pattern that we would see repeated down to our day. One group that you can blame is the Israeli electorate, because they never, almost never, hold their politicians accountable for their failures. So despite everything, the Labor Party won again. Although they lost five seats, from 56 to 51, the new Likud party just formed gained seven seats to 39, but Labor was in control again. The Likud successful revolution would be delayed four more years. Protest rallies demanded the formation of a commission of inquiry, and the Agronaut Commission met and released its findings April 1st, 1974, April Fool's Day, laying blame at the feet of Eli Zaira and his two aides, Shalev and Bondman, who had issued the report the day before as no war, and the chief of staff, David Elazar. Most controversially and peculiarly, it exempted Moshe Dayan and Golda Meir from any responsibility, leading people to accuse the commission of whitewashing the politicians and blaming the career military. Now, Herzog himself credits Meir for not striking first, but when he wrote, he also had a political career ahead of him in mind to consider. But that makes little sense. The fact is, there was accurate intelligence, but it was the politicians that evaluated it and ignored it. And even if there was only accurate intelligence, if the government resolves for political and or diplomatic reasons not to preempt, so what's the difference what the intelligence was? They would have responded the same way, except maybe mobilized reserves a little sooner. But the initial attack would have resulted in the same disaster. So the Agranat Commission really dropped the ball. Here, you see what happened as a result of the failure to preempt. Too many Jews were left defenseless, and too many Jews were killed unnecessarily. It was very easy to blame Eli Zeira, and he deserves blame, but he had no constituency to defend him, as the politicians did. But, give them credit for this, whatever the report said, a week after its issuance, Golda Meir resigned and retired from politics, because she felt she was to blame. Dayan was re-elected as a member of the ruling party, but was dismissed from the cabinet. He fell into a depression. His reputation as a dashing military genius in tatters. He'd surface again, and we'll encounter him in a few weeks, as Menachem Begin's foreign minister. And the Marat, after Meir resigned, turned to the only person who had no responsibility at all for the debacle, Yitzhak Rabin, because he had no official position. He had just returned right before the war from his diplomatic posting in Washington. The mood in Israel abruptly shifted from arrogance and invincibility post-1967 to gloom and despair. The losses were painful, and the sense of insecurity deepened, and these fears would play a role in the grasping at the straws of peace that we've especially witnessed in the last 20 years. The Arab oil weapon came into full force, the price of oil skyrocketed, leading to long gas lines in the U.S., and discontent with Israel almost overnight. Think about it. Plucky David HaMelech, the feisty victor of the Six-Day War against terrible odds, a numerically superior foe, that David almost overnight morphed into the evil Goliath persecuting and occupying the poor Palestinians. And once a conscious choice was made not to engage Israel militarily on a multi-front level, but to use the Palestinian card, you see how the entire tone of the conflict has changed, and really to Israel's detriment. Yom Kippur had another result. It heralded the birth of new settlements in Yesha to atone for what some said was the lack of love of Eretz Yisrael, as evidenced by the failure to settle it after 1967. And the locus of the conflict shifted from a war between countries to a war over the land of Israel itself, and there it has remained for 40 years. Well, would it have all been different had Israel struck preemptively? That is the question. For sure, the war would have been fought differently, if at all, and more successfully from Israel's perspective. Just as certainly, Sadat would not have come to Yerushalayim 4 years later if he had not won an initial victory on the battlefield and retained his foothold on the east bank of the canal. For some, that alone justified the sacrifice. For others, that was just another dreadful consequence of the Yom Kippur War. I thank you all very much. Next week, we are off of a wedding.